The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
This morning I'm going to read through and comment on a koan that is not part of our Boundless Way koan curriculum. In fact, it comes from much later, after the collections happened in the 17th century in China. And it's about a teacher whose name was Ziyong Chengru. And unlike most of the teachers we encounter through the history of Zen, she was a woman teacher, and she taught many people, both men and women, throughout her career. We know that she was born in 1645. We don't know when she died. But this koan is about a time when she was close to death. Master Ziyong Chengru was dying, and her disciple, the nun Jinsuan, was very anxious. Ziyong said to her, "From the beginning, there has been neither birth nor death, so what nirvana will there be?" But Jingxuan's grief continued. Ziyong then gave a shout, and Jinsuan went into a state of deep meditation. Ziyong called her out of it and asked, "At this moment, is there any nirvana, or is there not any nirvana?" Jingxuan said, "Your disciple from the beginning has experienced neither birth nor death. So what nirvana can there be?" Ziyong said, "This is what it is like before the dream." Jingxuan asked, "What is it like after the dream?" Ziyong said, "When you are in a dream, you still speak the language of dreams." When I came across this koan, which I first read in the collection of koans about women called The Hidden Lamp, I was very struck with that last line. And so I'll read it again. "When you are in a dream, you still speak the language of dreams." This is an interesting koan for me to sit with. This woman who was a poet and was a teacher, as I said, of many people. We know so little about her, although there is a collection of her writings, a little piece of which has been translated in the last few years. And this is part of that little piece. She had been given a couple of names, honorary names, by the Emperor of China at the time in the 17th century. And one of her names was Universal Compassion. And the other name was the Ship of Compassion. She didn't write, I don't think, that little piece that we have in our sutra book, which we read earlier today. But what a wonderful nickname. What a wonderful way to be referred. Even the emperor understood that she herself was someone who encountered the great way directly and was able to show other people the way, like a great ship, like the way that we think of the bodhisattva. When we take the bodhisattva vow, we are determined that all of our actions and all of our intentions move in the direction of helping other beings, helping this world that's full of suffering. And the emperor gave her this name, these names, Universal Compassion. Nobody left out. And the Ship of Compassion Nobody's left out. We all get to go on board and cross over the great ocean of birth and death to the other shore, where things become a bit more clear, where we stop being caught up in the particulars of our suffering, when we stop telling ourselves these very complicated narratives about why we have to hold on so tightly to our suffering, because it's ours, it's mine, and let me tell you what happened to me and what they did to me. Instead of holding tightly, we open the hand of thought. We allow things to have their true nature, which is the nature of impermanence, the nature of coming and going. And all things are like this. All things, the Buddha taught, come and go. In fact, his name, what he was called, or what he called himself, the Tathagata, in Sanskrit, it means the one who thus comes. And if you add an extra A that negates it in the middle, it's the one who thus goes. He knew that he himself was a being, a human being who came and went, who was born and who would die. And this is true of all of us. The great ocean of birth and death is something we all sail in. And as I said earlier, no exceptions, no exceptions for who's carried on the great ship of compassion, and also no exceptions for all of us. And the amount that we suffer is related to how we meet our suffering. So Master Ziyang was dying in this koan, in this dialogue between her and her disciple, Jin Xuan. Jin Xuan is already grieving the loss of her teacher. And you know how that goes. We pre-grieve. Some of us do it more than others as a form of protection, maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's just a way that we can create some pretty good stories in our mind about what death really is. If we hear the teaching, everybody dies, we think, well, then, when and how? And some of you know that wonderful song by Leonard Cohen, great singer-songwriter and also a Zen practitioner, Who by Fire, quoting something from the Bible, from the Old Testament, from the Hebrew Bible, how will you die? By fire, by water? And he just lists all the different ways that the scriptures list them and turns them into music and poetry more than they already are. The endless possibilities and the not knowing. We know we're going to die, but we don't know when, where, how. We don't know what will kill us. We don't know how much longer we have to be bodhisattvas on this planet, individually and together. We just don't know. We know that it'll come to an end. And if we wait long enough and if we figure out all the stuff that's going on with the world right now, many generations from now, the sun is supposedly going to explode and take us with it. It's all going to end. In Buddhist teachings, we talk about how worlds end and then are born again, and then end, and then born again, something way beyond what we can understand with our human lifetimes of decades. We just don't know. But the part that we can be sure of is that this won't last. And this is true not even in these big cosmic ways or even individual body ways, but even moment to moment. A sesshin is a wonderful opportunity to really see how this operates in the body and mind. If I'm sitting and my knee is really, really hurting, I can be reassured that at some point the jiki will ring the bell. And even though I want it now, I can just rest in the fact that this won't go on forever. If it does go on forever, then you need to see a doctor. Sitting still can create trouble, but if it lasts longer, then there might be something else going on. Just a little piece of wisdom about posture. So allowing ourselves to release into this truth of nothing lasts is neither a good thing nor a bad thing. Sometimes we make it good, sometimes we make it bad, but really it's just the way it is. Right now here in Worcester, it's raining. We can hear the rain from outside because the windows are open. It's a cool day. Those of you online might have wondered if there was something wrong with the microphones, the shh sound, just the sound of rain. Now the sound of a siren. And when it passes, it will pass. Someone somewhere needs help, and the siren, whether it's a fire engine or an ambulance or a police car, is heading to help. The whole world is saturated with this kind of compassion. We miss it because of our strong ideas about the way things should be. And in this koan, Jinxuan, the disciple, is very anxious. The translator used the word anxious here. Don't know what it was in Chinese, but I love that she did. Because anxiety is one of the things that human beings live with so much that sometimes we're not even awake to it. We don't know why we're doing the things that we're doing, but deep inside we're worried. We want it to be different than the way it is. It's one form that suffering, dukkha, takes, this anxiety, this fear. In the Heart Sutra, Shariputra says that when anxiety disappears, when fear disappears, then we find our freedom. But does it disappear? If we try to get rid of it, if we try to knock it down and kick it out, it comes back stronger. How do we work with our anxiety? Jinxuan is anxious about her teacher dying. All of us are anxious about something. It's just one of the many ways that we feel things. We also feel anger and sadness and many other forms of emotion. But this anxiety is so prevalent. I'm so worried about fill in the blank, the way the world seems to be heading, the way I'm heading, the way this talk is heading. It doesn't matter, but we are worried. I love that in Spanish, the word for anxiety is preocuparse, which means literally to preoccupy yourself. That's what anxiety is. It's sometimes it feels like endless preoccupation, often about ourselves, but sometimes about others in the world, but often how we're in connection with others in the world. This me, me, me that the Buddha said he was determined to undo, the sense of this self that needs to be protected at all costs. And that's, of course, where some of our anxiety arises from. Why is Jinxuan so anxious? Well, she doesn't want her teacher to die. I'm assuming when I get into her body and heart and mind, that's what I think. Maybe she's anxious about something else, though. Oh, no. If the teacher dies, I'm going to have to figure out how to do the whole funeral thing. And I don't even know if I'm well trained. It could be anything. But I think maybe her love for her teacher is very highly activated here, and probably is what is preoccupying her right now. So then Ziyang says this interesting thing, which in a way is an attempt at reassurance. From the beginning, there has been neither birth nor death. So what nirvana will there be? The central question of this koan. Nirvana, literally in Sanskrit, means cessation, extinction, the end of everything. And this is how we think about death. Sometimes we think about all of our troubles or our thoughts as maybe someday being extinguished, and that will lead us to the misunderstanding of the word nirvana, meaning some happy place, some place where there's no suffering. But nirvana simply means the end of something. And so we think of our life as ending. This is the nirvana of the human body. Ziyang is going to the emptiness place. All of us start out in life in the form world because that's what we have to learn how to navigate. We have to learn how we're going to be taken care of. We have to learn who to trust. We have to learn eventually how to eat, how to go to the bathroom on our own. We have to learn how to walk and sit up and talk and do all these things that happen in the first couple of years of life. And then, of course, they're so useful. It's so useful to know how to live in the form world. Not all of us are that good at it. It's true. We get really scrambled up. Some of us get a little bit distracted. We forget things that we're supposed to do. We forget how to be with other people. The form world doesn't fit all of us that well. But for a time, we can depend on it. And when we first come to Zen practice, it's usually because the form world hasn't been that comfortable for us. We sense that there's more. We sense that there's something else, something that will take us beyond this form world of suffering where things are born and things die and we can't control it. We might try to control it, but ultimately we can't. We might try to protect ourselves by avoiding the subject, but ultimately we can't. And when we encounter Zen, the form world shifts and changes, and we see that because nothing lasts, including our own self that we cling to so hard, so robustly, the me, I, and mine that keeps us going in the form world, we open up to another way of encountering life, which in Sanskrit is shunyata, which means thusness or nothingness or nothing solid. Often that word is translated as emptiness, but it's not empty in the sense that like a waste paper bucket is empty. It's empty of anything that is solid and continuous. So I prefer to use the word thusness or openness or spaciousness, because that's what happens when we have these little moments or big moments when the form world dissolves into something much bigger with much more possibility, with less worry, less anxiety, less self-preoccupation. When this happens for us, and I believe deeply, this is my story, that it's happened for everyone I've ever met. I've never met anyone who hasn't had just a little tip of the tongue taste or a glimpse of everything dropping away. Often when that happens, if we haven't been training in Zen or some other contemplative practice, we scramble to grab up everything that just dropped away and slap it on ourselves so that that we don't have to live in this other world of endless possibility. But through Zen practice, we create a way, we learn how to sustain that feeling of spaciousness. We hear talks like this, we work with teachers, one-on-one in Doksan. We have our Dharma dialogue where we get to show up with our questions and concerns. And all of those skillful means in Zen are ways to keep us going back again and again and again. It's a kind of cyclical process back to that little teeny tiny opening to kind of prop it open and get it to be bigger and bigger and more reliable and less worrisome. And then, of course, what happens, and this is directly relevant to this koan, we get attached to the feeling of spaciousness, of shunyata, of nothingness, of emptiness. It's so nice, so yummy to not have to worry so much, to not cling to the form world anymore. I remember this happening to me. I remember this happening to me a number of times where I just thought, great, done. I don't have to worry anymore. Other people will take care of things. I'll just, oh, wait a minute. And then the door would just shut when I started having thoughts like that. Maybe that's familiar to some of you or all of you too. So what ultimately happens in our Zen training is that we notice when we're stuck in the form world, and we notice when we're stuck in the world of shunyata also, when we're relying on it in a narrow way to protect ourselves from form, when we cling to nothingness, when we cling to spaciousness, we may stumble and fall in the form world. And ultimately, the form world and the world of shunyata come together in our practice, and we begin to see that you can't have one without the other, that life is both form and emptiness, as the Heart Sutra so beautifully tells us. Again and again, we hear this, but we don't really believe it. I experienced emptiness. Oh, this is going to be it forever. Or forget about that. I don't know what they're talking about. What's this form stuff? I'm relying on that. So here the teacher goes to the emptiness place. There's been neither birth or death. So what nirvana will there be? And Jing Xuan, to her great credit, keeps grieving. We can imagine her crying and howling and rolling around. This is big grief. Many of us have experienced it. Some of us have tried to prevent it from happening by pushing it away. In my experience, it always comes back. Opening to this, Jing Xuan shows us a way to live where there's nothing that gets in the way. When we're sad, we're sad. When we're worried, we're worried. When we're in pain, we're in pain. She keeps going. And Ziyang then does something that apparently she was very famous for, which many Zen teachers have been famous for. She gives a shout. No words are possible here to penetrate the grief of her disciple. She shouts, and in that loud sound that is not even a word, she somehow penetrates her disciple's heart. And she immediately goes into a state of awakened samadhi, just stillness, just this, nothing, nothing but this. Not really clinging to emptiness, but a great response to the shout that's neither form nor emptiness. And Ziyang calls her disciple out of that state. And she says, at this moment, is there any nirvana or is there not any nirvana? What is your experience right now? Are you leaning into the emptiness world or the form world? No nirvana, cessation. What's going on for you? And Jing Xuan repeats what her teacher said earlier. She says, your disciple from the beginning has experienced neither birth nor death. So what can there be? And this word experience is very important here. We don't remember being born. At least I don't. Maybe there's sense impressions in the body of coming out of the womb into the air and light. But we don't really remember what happened, and we don't know what it will be like after we die. And here we get into the real matter. You might say the central or essential matter. Ziyang, the teacher, says this is what it's like before the dream. Before anything takes shape, before we think, I know what this is, we're all living in the dream world. We awaken in the dream of life and death. Again, we don't know what will happen or even what has happened. Those are just stories we tell ourselves. And we can't even know what's happening right this moment. But things do have this wonderful tendency to be penetrated and to drop away. To realize that the dream is happening now. The disciple Jing Xuan asks, what is it like after the dream? What is it like when we penetrate the dream world and awaken to this life that is maybe beyond everything we can ever imagine? And Ziyang says, when you're in a dream, you speak the language of dreams. When you're in this life, we might say, you engage fully with this life, not some idea of another life. When you're in the dream and you're grieving, you grieve in dream language, which is our ordinary language. You allow yourself to be fully present, and when things get in the way, you're fully present to those things too. I want to end by reading something that that Ziyang wrote that directly bears on all of this. She says, the Dharma does not rise up alone. This teaching that we're engaged with here, it doesn't come by itself. We set up conditions for it. We know this. And then she goes on to say, it can't emerge without reliance on the world. Every footstep we take, every breath that comes in and goes out, this is our reliance on the world. And the Dharma won't manifest without the world. We do not escape the world. This is so important to know, that Zen is not any kind of escape. She goes on to say, if I take up the challenge of speaking, I must surely borrow the light and the dark, the form and the emptiness of the mountains and hills and the great earth, the call of the magpies and the cries of the crows. The water flows and the flowers blossom, brilliantly preaching without ceasing. In this way, there is no restraint. Jing Xuan asks, what is it like after the dream? And Ziyang says, when you're in a dream, you still speak the language of dreams. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and we'll reshape the Zendo into our half circle. And this is the time for our Dharma dialogue. So I'm going to be joined by Michael and David in responding to you. And if you have something that you want to offer or ask about or look into, then raise your hand here in the Zendo, raise your actual physical hand, and on Zoom, raise your Zoom hand. And I think we have a microphone up here, and Laura has a microphone there, so we'll use them in our responses. And also, so you all on Zoom can hear the people in the Zendo. So I'll go back and forth between the Zendo and the Zoom Zendo. We'll start with Rick.
Thank you for your...
Oh, so just pause a moment and we'll get your... Oh. Yep. Oh, look at that.
Thank you for your wonderful talk, Melissa. Very much in there to contemplate. I was especially struck by the shout, which moved the disciple who seemed to be trapped in her grief and couldn't move outside of it, because inherently grief is not a bad thing. It's a bonding emotion, connects, and so all the things of this world, all the feelings, the anxiety, all of it can awaken us, and the awaken us to see things differently out of our ignorance. So since the world of form, when separate from the openness of the absolute, is the world of suffering. And it seems to me, anyway, this separation is the cause of our suffering. And so it seems that the going back and forth between form and the awareness that form is impermanent, and that yet the openness, the absolute, is not permanent, is hard to live by.
Yes. Yes, so much in this koan and Ray, so much in what you said. But I think the point that catches me is how these very emotions, whatever is going on, is both trap and entry point, right? We can tell the story and over and over and over and get kind of taken away, carried away by that story. And so this shout, this interruption, and of course, harsh life does this to all of us, right? Could be some person, could be some event, something cuts through whatever story we have, and this possibility of both entering where we are and also cutting through at the same time. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. No Zoom hands yet. Any other physical hands?
Interested in your in a dream that you speak the language of dreams, and caught or thinking about the way that the language we speak here is can be also not the real, not the thing we're after, like the way the language, the when you're in a dream, the language of you speak the language of dreams, and I guess not getting caught in speaking a different language, which is still a language, feels important to me. Or I wonder how that plays in on the other side.
Yeah, I'm what comes up for me as you're talking, Jamie, all through the talk, I was thinking this, but I didn't say it out loud, that we sometimes call we say that the Buddha has three bodies, three kinds of bodies. And one of the bodies is the dream body, which is, you know, poetry and magic and actual dreaming, the way we often think of dreams. And some of us really love to live in that place. And then there's the Nirmanakaya, which is more the form level of the Buddha, the really activity level. And then the Dharmakaya, which encompasses them both, kind of when you bring it all together. So to find the appropriate way to meet circumstances with language, I think that's what Ziyang is pointing to. And that's what I'm hearing you two to not mistake some other kind of way of describing things when you're actually in this way of describing things. Is that close to what you were looking at?
Yeah.
And it's all of us know which world we're most attracted to, I think, right? The form world, the dream world, the absolute, like the Ray brought in that word for it. And we want to make sure we can speak the language of all three worlds. And actually, there are countless worlds right there.
And like when someone's suffering, it's rarely helpful to say, but we're all one. There's no problem, right? So we speak the language and we honor the form and emptiness through whatever means we can at the moment to meet the moment, not to bypass it.
And Ziyang tried to do that at first. The first encounter is, you know, oh, let's look into nirvana, sort of a way, you know, to cut it out, stop crying. And that's not helpful for most people. But the shout was helpful, right? Because as David said, it cut through conception. And a lot of grief is conception. Yeah, thank you. Let's go to the Zoom screen, Craig.
Thank you for the talk, Melissa, and for introducing us to another woman teacher. I always appreciate that. Something you said struck me that I may not have understood properly. I thought you said that with practice you can return to an open and improper open or have more skill. And it sounds like you could intend to open yourself. In my experience, if ever it happens, it just happens. And, you know, I've had openings where some mundane thing would say, oh, yes. And then that mundane thing happens over and over again and never again.
Right. And that's an important distinction you're making. I'm really happy that you're saying that because I didn't mean to imply that you're going to do it. Right. But we often say that awakening is an accident and Zen practice makes you accident prone. So you are deciding. All of us here have decided to come to Sesshin, which is one of the things that seems to help to prop that door open. Right. It's like the shout. It just like there's a certain point we're not getting as much sleep as usual and we're sitting long periods, never more than 25 minutes, I think. But it builds up in a certain way. So we can't maintain, we can't do the thing that you're saying we could use to try to wake up, right? The intentionality of the story-making mind. Instead, it kind of starts wearing off. So we can intend to practice, but we can't intend to wake up, right? Does that... Yeah. So it's a fine distinction.
I was thinking there might be a Zen pry bar that I hadn't encountered yet.
A Zen what?
Zen pry bar.
Oh, Zen pry bar, right. Oh, yeah, we're going to sell those online, make a fortune. Merch.
I love this question and what you're saying, Craig, because it, in essence, what we're really doing is we're intending to align ourselves with the flow of life and so that it happens, but we can't make it happen. Mm-hmm. But our intention is in alignment. We just don't see it until we're there.
Thank you, Craig. Somebody in the Zendo. Yep, Anne.
Yeah, I'm interested. We keep using the word cutting through stories and using the language of something. And there seems another way of knowing that I've used the word intuitive and I've been put down for it, but a nonverbal way of knowing that isn't quite as rigid, as clear cut as form, but is not to emptiness either. There's a space in the middle that I think we're at much more frequently than we are, that I'm at much more frequently than I'm at any kind of emptiness in that middle place.
Well, there's no boundary, right? I appreciate you kind of saying this because if we look closely at our experience, it isn't captured by these things, right? Form and emptiness. Okay, now I'm in the form world. Now I'm not in the form world. So I think we are in this place, and as we settle down, maybe we can become aware of some subtle movement that is not about cutting through anything, but about being present. And I think the last quote that Melissa read about, you can't do this without the world. So it's about this ongoing and this interaction, and the words are not the bad things we have to get away from to do this, but the words themselves are empty and on the boundary. So it's not clear cut.
I think when we talk of form world, we're usually talking of something that can be when we talk of form world, we're usually talking of something that can be verbalized. Or we're often talking of something that can be verbalized.
Well, there's many ways to talk about everything. You know, I think what David's pointing to, and I really appreciate the quality of looking deeply into what these things really are, and experience, just like the disciple, like really she experienced something. And that's what we're doing. And to not limit ourselves, you know, to a narrow band that isn't form or isn't emptiness. The reality, just what Michael was saying before about we're joining in with the flow of life, which moves to all these different places. And like Jamie said, all these different languages. And sometimes they're pointing languages like poetry and music and sometimes and art. And sometimes they're story making languages, but they're all dream language.
And there is no world of form. I mean, in the there is this free. There is a world of form. There is a world of form. I take it back. But the world of form is empty, we can't really talk about what's going on. We can point and say, well, you know, that's a Columbine. But to say that's a Columbine captures something, but it does not capture the essence of coming and going and life and death and the universe appearing right here.
Yeah, thank you. Michael? Yeah.
I'm feeling where you're coming from, because I think the word world throws me off. We say there's a form, an emptiness world. It sounds like there's something called emptiness that exists outside of form. Those are just views. It's the form view of the entire world and the emptiness view of the entire world.
Nice. Thanks. Yeah, let's go over to the Zoom Zendo, Esther.
So thank you for bringing in a woman teacher. I felt that very much, the sweetness of that. Thank you for that. The last two sentences about dream, speaking the language, can you read them loud one more time, just because I'm not?
Yeah. Actually, the last three is, because yes. Ziyang says, this is what it is like before the dream. Mm-hmm. And then Jing Xuan says, what is it like after the dream? What is it like after the dream? And Ziyang says, when you're in a dream, you still speak the language of dreams.
Right. So where that took me was at first. So asking the question, what comes after the dream? You know, when we do this exploration, wanting to know more deeply, I felt that maybe what the teacher said pointed to when we're lost in wanting to ask more questions rather than staying with some kind of mystery. I went with that for a little bit. And then I'm also thinking the dreams, when you're in the world of dreams, you live fully in that, in the world of form, but it could also contain the opposite. So what I received or what I sat with was, you know, when we're in our delusion around things, you know, stuck in these dreams and ideas about things. Anyways, that's kind of what hit
me. Yeah, what happens when we're stuck in that?
Well,
place?
The lack of intimacy with just being with what was right, very alive in that moment of the pre-grief, as you described it, or the intimacy with that, wanting to have answers to questions that somehow take us out of just being in that space with your teacher dying.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I think you're pointing to something very touching. You know, the thing itself is usually not that complicated. Right. And so when we're in the dream, we speak the language of dreams. Mm-hmm. When we're grieving, we speak the language of grief. Mm-hmm. Right? When we're angry, we speak the language of anger. When we're confused, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We directly meet the world as it's showing up. Yeah. All right. Oh my gosh, a lot of hands. I saw Dave before.
Yeah. Thanks for the talk. There is a question here, but it's not totally formulated. But when I listened to the koan, what came to me was this feeling of almost like nostalgia and sadness, this kind of thing. And so, and it took me to this, my own experience of sitting at, with me, it wasn't my teacher, but my dad, sitting at his deathbed. Mm-hmm. And feeling the same thing about sadness and anxiety that the student felt. And so it was very, in some sense, it was easy to relate to the student. And in my mind, I was like, oh, I know how she feels. Mm-hmm. I felt like that. So mm-hmm. there's some natural compassion there. And then I was thinking about like, okay, but what about the teacher who's on her deathbed? What is that feeling? I've never been on my deathbed, so I can't really know. So I tried to feel it like, okay, like it's this nostalgia, maybe that trying to understand. So, but I couldn't really. So one of the, I felt more connected, more compassionate with the student and the teacher. And so, but then I thought, well, how do I know really what the student is feeling? I only know what I'm feeling. So if I think I know, maybe I get it wrong. I miss it. And then I don't actually know. So the question is kind of when we think we know what someone's feeling, or when we don't know at all, how do we like connect to it? Like, how do we, is there some experience of like, we kind of know, but we don't really know, but how, like, I guess, how do we connect if we don't really know what the other person is feeling in some sense?
I don't really know what you're talking about. Right, but I have some idea, right? You say something and it sparks something in me. So we're all dreaming this whole time, and in these koans we're encouraged to dream into the characters, and we can notice that some feel quite easy, like, oh yeah, I really identify. Of course there's some truth with that, but I love your opening the fact that it's actually broader than whatever we're thinking. If we're talking with someone and they say, oh, I'm sad, we say, oh, yeah, I know what you're feeling. Well, not so. You know, I may have some sense. I may feel something between us. I know things for myself. So I think, one, we have to trust what arises, but this curiosity, what's beyond that? And then noticing where there are boundaries, right? We meet someone and I just can't, you know, get into this person. Mm-hmm. I can't empathize. I think we just meet that and notice that. notice what it brings up in us. It is a kind of connection to feel disconnected. Right? And if we trust the Dharma, we can trust, wow, with this person, it's something not here for me, or I can't understand. And then the not understanding is fine too.
There's a way that we really can resonate with another person, but maybe not with the story they're carrying in their head about what's happening to them. And the mistake we sometimes make if we're people who are very sympathetic, very empathic, is that we'll try to match our story to what we're perceiving as happening. But actually, that's too much. The resonating is enough. And you can trust it. What I wanted to say to you immediately was, you already know the answer to this question. You know, your question is exactly to the point. This is something you experience so much. And it's heartbreaking. And some of us are like this. But then we make the extra step of saying, oh, well, this must be what you're feeling, right? And that before you get to that, it's just, ouch, oh, no, right? That's how it is. Yeah. Thank you. And let's see. Oh, we've got some hands on Zoom now too. Michael C.
So I was struck by how quickly I sort of skated over the concept of anxiousness, anxiety, without really trying to think, okay, and this was triggered also by what Esther said, that for me, anxiety is the alarm that points to the thing that I'm in denial of, right? The emotion, whatever it is that my sense of self is saying, I need this away, you know, push, 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 right? It's the arrow pointing to, here's the where the work is. And I think, at least for me, that was the disciple. It sounded to me like that was the disciple's refusal to really be with her grief, to really be with the acceptance, embrace, okay, this is death happening. It's sad for me, and that it maybe reflected her resistance to her own sadness, causing that churn rather than the sadness itself, which she could be with and be present with and then move past. And that was maybe, without that, the teacher would not have had to do anything.
Yeah. Well, what a wonderful story that you've created. I mean, that's just what we were talking about, because what I heard was that you have a pattern around how you meet anxiety, and that you recognized it happening in hearing the story for yourself. The skating, I love the skating as a word for what we do, the spiritual bypass, right? We do it. Many of us do it. I think all of us do it sometimes, just don't want to deal with it. And then what David was saying about how we, our duty really as people of the way is to dream ourselves into the people in the stories. So you did that. This was Michael's version of that disciple. And that's completely 100% authentic. And that's where you start looking. You know, that's the only thing you can start with. Your story is the only thing you have about it. You can't make up another story that somebody else said. You don't know what her story was, but you can feel it. And then watch that second layer happen. The storytelling is the second layer. And that's where we don't meet each other, but that's where you can meet yourself, which is so important and so revelatory. So thank you for that. Yeah, thanks. And we've got up near Jenny. So why don't we do Jenny, and then we'll go to Paul later.
I was thinking about the preoccupied and the pre-grief and the stories, and thinking how the stories and the simulations are what enables me to act. Like this thing should be over there. Like I picture that, and then I can carry that thing over there. And the pre-grief, I've thought about my old dog. I'm just like, this is going to happen pretty soon. I'm going to have to bear the unbearable pretty soon. And pretty much everybody could be walking around with that all the time and is. Yeah. And preoccupied, like if I can fill myself up with this, then I don't have to let that in. Maybe it's some kind of defensive thing. So the stories, the things should be otherwise. It's what enables us to act, but it's also what hurts. So I don't know.
Well, and the pre-grieving, it's probably not pre-grieving because already happened, right? And to be aware of the transience and the reality of life and death, in some ways you treasure your old dog even more, and not, let me work through the grief so I can be here. But for all of us here, this preciousness of this circle and this time here, I think knowing grieving is appropriate. Because otherwise we're like, yeah, the dog, I got the dog forever, right? or here we are forever. No, so precious. Right. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. So let's just do a couple more. We've got Susan Lamar on Zoom.
Yeah, so like everybody else, I'm having a real hard time figuring out a say in language what I'm grieving about this con. So I'll just throw this into the mix. As the koan has kind of washed through me, it occurred to me that in a sense there's four characters. Two of form and two of emptiness that are all sort of mixing. We've got the form are the people, the humans, trying to grapple with emptiness, grief, and dreams. And I have no idea where I'm going with that, but that's what this koan feels like to me, that these characters somehow are mixing their stories and their non-stories. And I know this makes no sense whatsoever, but
it makes a lot of sense, Susan, just so you know.
Okay. Yeah, keep going. And anyway, so that's just where I am with it. I'm sort of in that form and emptiness kind of swirling together. The word I used yesterday was bewilderment, and it's that. And what a cool place to be. I mean, it's just so
well, thank you, I guess. Yeah, the way you're describing the all the people are populating the koan and all the different ways that that's what's happening right here. Mm-hmm. That's what Sesshin does, you know, that we all come in our separate little bubbles, and then the bubbles start wearing away and we don't even know what's going on anymore. It is bewildering. It really is. And that's appropriate. You know, that's one of the ways that we know that things are wearing off. Mm-hmm. When we're bewildered. It's not a problem. It's a feature, you know,
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. So bewilder on. Thank you. And I think Paul had his hand up and has the mic.
Thank you, Melissa, for the talk, and really enjoying the Dharma dialogue as well and everything that's coming up. I was taken by what I perceived this, friendly playfulness with knowing and not knowing, especially at the beginning, this kind of, you know, really firm certainty. I know I'm going to die. I mean, you didn't say that, but that's what's coming up, you know, so I know this. And, in the Zendo here, I often feel like I have given primacy to don't know. And, you know, this, so I really appreciate this kind of playfulness of knowing and don't know, and, you know, knowing what I don't know and all the other iterations could go there. And it just opened up for me when you were talking and when hearing other people talk, is that I have this idea that knowing and don't knowing are like questions and answers. And I tell my university students all the time that answers will often close things down and questions will open things up. So somehow I've made this connection that don't know opens things up. So I need to be open, you know? And, but when I'm hearing you say, Michael, and also David, a little bit, that, you know, there is no world of form. There is no world of emptiness. There are these views. And both the knowing and the don't knowing are opening. I think there's really a possibility there. I've often woken up from a dream and I'm anxious because of whatever's happened to the dream. I can know that it was a dream, but I also know that I'm anxious right now. And so knowing that it was, quote, just a dream does not negate the fact that I'm anxious right now. And here it is. And so, and it just seems like a series of knowing and don't knowing, but always opening to each of those.
Just to say that, you know, I really appreciate you that trying to pin that between knowing and not knowing. For me, it's wonder.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wonder is what arises. And I've heard it said that, I can't remember, said wonder is the thing that your knowledge can't eat.
That your knowledge can't eat. That's pretty cool.
And really appreciate you talking about knowing, not in the small sense, but it may be knowing as intimacy. We don't have to pretend, well, I don't know anything. Entering into this knowing, this meeting, this touching, and being touched and delighting in it, entering through it. Yeah. Thanks.
So thank you. Thank you all. And please put the Zendo back together and we will go on to the next part of the dream.